Jones, he married Mabel, a wise old owl was he. He told his wife he never drank a stronger thing than tea. But after honeymooning, at night he stayed away. And for a week he never got home till the break of day. At last poor Mabel asked the reason why. Said Jones, I'm going to tell the truth or die. Baby dear,
hello and welcome back to our podcast. Our fanfic and the fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, a popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Hi, I'm Fi. I'm joined once again with my co-host, Weird. Say hello, Weird.
Hey there, horses and other assorted vertebrates. It's your pal, DJ Weirdington Esquire. Still doing a Wolfman Jack impression for the duration of Thunderhead 2020.
Thunderhead. Oh Christ.
Man, it was a real rip snorer last week. I hope you're ready.
Actually, it got a little spicy toward the end. Let's see what we learned last week. Well, the heroes refused to call out Lighthooves for his claimed beneficent motivations, all the while his plan involves spreading a maddening cannibalism disease to every pony. All of them.
Every single one of them.
And incidentally, just so happens, make himself the supreme leader of the only safe place in the universe. Really, really showing every sign of being the kind of person who will burn down the entire world just so long as he is the most important person left on the center. But no one calls him out for this. Because the author fundamentally agrees with his motivating philosophies. We also found out that Rainbow Dash has been alive this entire time, and secretly the hero that the city of Thunderhead needs to want to deserve to want to need to deserve to want Dark Knight.
Also, apparently within 200 years she had become like an absolute goddamn bootlicker over the course of that. Batman.
Which led us, man. Thunderhead has been a season of awakenings and the falling away of masks. Because the previous week, Somber got so egregious that his mask slipped, and it finally occurred to us that Blackjack isn't allowed to beat men, is she?
No, not even a little bit.
Ain't that weird? And the only explanation for how this, like, undead walking tank, who is, like, constantly sort of referred to as like, magically destined to be the right hand of death.
The right hoof of death.
Yeah, can't beat this motherfucker. Why? He's Nightwing. Anything else? Yeah. No. Okay.
A little bit. Yep.
And then she clowns on like a Necron queen. Yes. All right.
That's going to get even more infuriating in this chapter.
But this week there was the sort of nightmare reveal that I've been struggling for a long time to try and parse like what the fuck the creative spark beyond this project is. Like, why is Somber doing any of this if he's not trying to tell a story? Like, if he doesn't even know like the basic like Campbell like 8 plot point wheel, like what the fuck is he like trying to do here? And Rainbow Dash turning out to be a fascist clinches it. Like is the final like my God, the yarn on the wall like comes together. It's to destroy K-Cat's work. It is to retroactively lay claim to and recontextualize, retcon somebody else's labor.
And masquerade as if it is their own.
Yeah, yeah, it's gross and horrible. And the worst part is that he's more or less succeeded.
Yeah, it worked.
With a pretty large crowd of people.
That's the soul destroying revelation, is that it worked.
Yeah, all of this like nonsense, reductive retro, like recontextualizing horse shit is largely regarded as canon. But there is a little bit of light in that. During the course of this week, I told some longtime friends about this podcast, and one of them said the extremely reassuring thing of, "Oh, I read FOE like as a kid a long while back. I haven't read any of the other stuff, though." Good. Hooray. Hooray. That. There's that, at least. And I think that pretty much sums up last week. Oh, we closed out on what would have been funny. I guess I would have given it more credit at the time, but I was already pretty burnt by the dark reveals of, like, the core nature of this beast, this horrible thing that Sombra has done. Marking him as a deeply horrible person who no one should ever respect. Which was the Enclavers had captured the Fallen Glory, and we're about to pull her out of the bag as we've captured Rainbow Dash. Your rebellion ends here, Antifa. But when they pull her out, she's just some dumb horse. She's just some idiot.
Yeah.
Which is egg in their face. Pretty great.
Yeah, because for those playing at home, she turned into Rainbow Dash in the first place because she was exposed to Killing Joke. And the way Killing Joke works in this story, pretty much only, it lasts as long as it's funny. And then when it stops being funny, it arbitrarily stops working. But I mean, like, there's no indication that that's true at all in anything else. And that doesn't explain how we have two, like, seahorse ponies that are just, I guess, like, because I think it'd be really funny if they were underneath the water and they suddenly turn back into not water-breathing horses. But whatever, because the whole point of Killing Joke is supposed to kill you, but who cares? We get a wah wah. Oh no, she's back to being regular horse, one winged and all. Which I guess leads us into this goddamn chapter. Oh boy. So last week I was hemming and hawing a lot over whether or not, like how we were gonna cover this. I guess, like, was I gonna do it as two chapters? Was I gonna do it as one chapter? Because detail about the finale, because that's what we're in right now. We're in the finale of this book. Seems like it was only yesterday. Is that it was so long, it was broken up into two chapters. And I think that the length of this chapter versus its content is a testament to how, as a writer, you have to make sacrifices and you have to cut shit out. Otherwise, you end up with a 50,000 word long chapter that goes nowhere for the first half because of a dumb, stupid indulgence on your behalf.
God, good thing Sombra had so many editors on his team and so many people there to check him.
Yeah, like I can't speak for all of the editors, but every editor I've ever seen talk about this story is an absolute goddamn, like, yes men bootlicker, and like it's embarrassing how much of a true believer they are of this all of this work. Like, for funsies, I think when we do the wrap up, I'm gonna crack out some of the Reddit posts that I've seen over the last couple of weeks, and we could talk about how, like, even the editors, like, wildly recontextualize and what's the word I'm looking for when you rehabilitate? They wildly try to rehabilitate the actions of the characters in the story to not be that bad. Anyways, I guess I should probably quit stalling so much. So, chapter 62, part 1, Between the Wolf and the Lion.
Fuck.
So... I strongly considered skipping this chapter because this chapter is 90% a fight scene. It is a big, long, dumb aerial battle fight scene with no stakes or context of anything. So it was almost something that I skipped. This was almost going to turn into another It Was All a Dream chapter where we just like skipped it entirely and pretended it didn't happen. But anyways, there is some small things to talk about, so I guess I should get to them. So this chapter opens with a riot because everyone's turned on everyone.
Really strong social cohesion in this paradise. Like
that's a super odd thing about this too, is because like you'd think that like this could almost be saying something, but it's looked on it's looked on with a tear.
It's almost
but like
always saying something. It's
what could have been? What could have been if only these ponies weren't turned against each other, brother against brother. Turned against each other in this final hour. It's treated as like a damn shame that everyone's turned on each other because Thunderhead is gone. Like Lighthooves has tricked Thunderhead into thinking that Lighthooves has revealed to them that Nevarro is coming to attack them, and so there's an immediate split, like within seconds, between loyalists and Thunderheaders. Within seconds, they're already at each other's throats.
Yeah, which Summer doesn't realize implies simmering resentment.
Yes, and that this place wasn't a paradise. But sure, context is important, and he doesn't provide any of that.
It's funny to me. Like I'm having fun with it because it just reminds me of the beginning of the podcast and like our first big example of this sort of thing, which was the gun, the Mega Mart, the gun, gun be praised.
To an extent, yes.
And that like Somber, like there's some part of Somber that is conscious. Like there's some part of Somber there's gotta be like, it just keeps this happens too often for Somber to be totally oblivious.
So I don't think it's a matter of obliviousness or not. I think he's just so myopic that, like, it comes across as a deconstruction. I think the intent is really just that, like, nope, everything just collapses because everyone's evil, ha ha ha, and not because there's, like, it's trying to say anything that's, like, of a deeper meaning than just, like, void nihilism.
Yeah. It's... it's hilarious that he tries to play this off as like an unnatural event and a tragedy and something that would never have happened if it weren't for the machinations of Lighthooves, turning this otherwise perfectly ordered and unified ethnic bloc against itself. You and I, dear listener, we know the score. or at least, if you're not in the score, an inherent element of fascism is the friend enemy distinction. His name escapes me at the moment. But one of the driving philosophers behind Nazism. Created this philosophical concept called the friend enemy distinction, which basically boils down to it is impossible to have friends without an enemy. The only way to create a social cohesion
is a unified foe to be defeated, which is why the Forever War is required, because otherwise peace would like not be possible.
And why you have to keep inventing new foes. It is always possible to divide your population by a new metric. You can always find a new trait to vilify. And since this place is built on a foundation of hatred and resentment, this sort of thing is expected and inevitable.
Yes.
I don't know, just kind of funny.
Yes, it's just one of those, huh, makes you think. but yeah,
Schmidt, Carl yes. Schmidt.
Yes. Yay, the crew splits up again, even though they've just all reconvened. There's kind of almost like a comedy in this, so basically like, all right, Blackjack, Rampage, the only people who can do anything, you go solve the plot. No, like it's this dumb thing where like they're splitting up because of the people that can like handle the problem, because like basically BJ's plan now is, because the shit has now thoroughly hit the fan, is they're gonna go talk to the general that they're friends with and try to get this all called off somehow, or at least like get in to go stop Lighthooves personally or some stupid shit.
I thought that was the first dude to die. Like, I thought Lighthooves murked that asshole.
No, it was a different general. It was there was the Lighthooves, like, Lighthooves has its own, like, body of politics. This is the, like, general that, like, you know, like, the really, like, affable Nazi that, like, drank the tea that they met early? Like,
right
away? General Storm Chaser, which is barely not Stormfront. I didn't notice that until this chapter, that's like, huh, her name is really dicey when you think about it.
I'm not on that. I don't know.
Given how these are rehabilitated Nazis,
in the greater context, a little sus, but.
Oh, I don't think it's intentional. I'm just saying, like, it's funny. It's like, so from now on, I'm going to call her General Stormfront, because, like,
okay.
Fuck this.
Valid. Valid. I just fuck every part of this. Like, I think we've gotten past the point where, like, a good faith critique means anything. Like, once we've realized the obvious critique, like the inescapable critique, then like, oh yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
we no longer have to take this seriously.
Well, it's the thing is, I also think we've said everything we can say, but to like reinforce our statement that like,
yeah,
the Enclave are Nazis. Like, they are not, they are deeply fascist sky ethnostate. They are not like just, oh shucks, we're just a bunch of Southern rebels doing everything we can. They are thoroughly Nazis, and that all of, like, I reject Sombra's premise at a hand. Like, his every attempt that he gives to try and like rehabilitate their image, I reject entirely at a hand, because I think it's an absolute absurd and disgusting thing to do in the first place. But the fact that he keeps trying has just really gotten on my nerves. But anyways, that's the plan. Turns out Blackjack has had the cure to the disease in her backpack the entire time. They're like,
what?
If we had a sample of the disease, we could, like, a pure sample of the disease, we could make a cure with Dr. Morningstar. And she's like, huh, let me rummage in my backpack. It basically produces them a Lunchable that was contaminated with the disease from Stable 99. So depending on, like, how far, how stretched the timeline is, that was either days or months ago.
Didn't they have a whole fucking adventure in a prison complex where that was the sole goal of the other people who were there, was to get a pure sample? Like,
yes.
And it turns out that the one that she has,
yeah, she just had a Lunchable. Like,
she kept some tainted wood chips from the like cannibalism potato chip generator.
Yes,
and from a vintage from the cannibal vintage.
Yes,
from the cannibal disease, from the Wendigo vintage.
It's excuse is the stupidest thing. It's just like, I don't know. I guess I just forgot to clean up my backpack. Saddlebags, technically, but whatever. Divine providence. How stupid it is. Like, this is fuck. I didn't have a solution to this problem. So Blackjack just had it on her the whole time.
I mean, this is the kind of shit that happens when like you write everything chapter to chapter. You don't plan ahead, and you don't have editors who like are there to put a gun to your head and say, "I need an outline. give me your outline for the book.
Produce for me your outline." But yeah, but I guess that's what Glory's job is to go make the cure. Which is cool, I guess. So, which is why she gets to be out of the story again. We then scene cut to BJ and Rampage are on a Skywagon, which I haven't had to explain up until this point. Basically, in the weird wastes of Fall Equestria, in the distant Golden Age past, they had like basically cars. They were just like wagons that like you could hook a Pegasus up to, and then they had magic on them to make them basically weightless as long as a Pegasus was flying them. And they were used as like cars and taxi services and stuff like that. Little Pip gets one at the end of Fall Equestria, and they fly it around, and it's cool. But she's just whatever. She's flying on one by the dumb Nazis that she's become friends with, whose names I cannot bother to remember because they're really unimportant. But yeah, they get to General Stormfront's ship, and she's convinced that Blackjack is a trap, which is really stupid. It's one of those things where it's like, I'm telling you the truth. That's what a traitor would tell me to, like, would tell you if she was trying to betray you. It's very pointless, stupid nonsense that really only gets solved when, like, Blackjack just, like, yells at her hard enough that, like, if I was going to do any of this stuff, like, why would I come to you and why would I tell you this, all this information? Like, what would I have to gain? And also, Rampage gets to actually talk in this scene, which is fucking wild. Rampage just is like, even if you didn't trust her, like, taking her out of the equation is ridiculous. Like, locking her up in a box isn't going to help, because she's just going to bust her way out and kill you all anyways. So, like, what's the point? Like, might as well just skip that part and get to the part where she helps you.
You know things are going well for your writing project when plot protection, plot armor is diegetic.
Yes, when it gets lampshaded all the goddamn time.
When like, you know that you're going to, like, just fucking be grotesquely lazy about it, and it is such a guaranteed inevitability that, like, the cast knows.
BJ realizes that Lighthooves can spy on them, because he stole the dumb thing that Chicanery has, and so has just been, like, watching them, I guess, do this stuff. And they, like... There's this, a lot of those weird...
And in his pristine white blonde hands, he is able to overcome its normal battery limit.
Yes. Now it's in its rightful hands. He can use it no matter what.
Indefinitely.
Yes. He's got the Sharingan eyes. They also finally actually think about what the fuck, like, why Dawn was up here at all in the first place. Like, there's a lot of lazy writing here. Like, that, like, it's the kind of, like, really mechanical, necessary writing of, like, your characters need to figure out a bunch of stuff because, like, you haven't, because you're a shit writer and you haven't bothered to actually have those conversations in the story. Like, when BJ and Dawn are fighting, you didn't have sections where they were, like, Dawn was gloating about her dumb plan. You instead had Cognitum just yell, like, through her as a loudspeaker.
Backfill, tell, don't show, it's backfill.
Yes.
Don't you know?
So it's this insane plan that, like, because the whole thing is, like, since they're technically in the core and they're technically above the core... Lighthooves' plan is to activate the defense system and just, like, laser them out of the sky. And BJ, like, cottons on, it's like, wait a second, if they activate the core, that's gonna release a whole bunch of enervation, because it's, like, being tied to that, because if you run electricity through, like, enervated metals, it, like, produces more enervation. That's just how it works. So this is just gonna just be a big enervation ball that's gonna kill everybody up here, and, like, the reason Dawn was here is because she was, like, gonna come get her family, I guess, because she knew that this was gonna turn into a big bloodbath no matter what happened. So you know all those sections where Blackjack is kicking herself over blaming herself for all this happening because of her? Turns out, no, actually, nah. This was always going to happen, and there's nothing she could have done about it.
She came up here to, like, rescue her family and not... I'm missing something. Who...
Dawn did.
Who installed, like, the innervated metal?
Dawn came up here to save her, like, dumb family.
Yeah, but not to reaping. Install, like, the rings of, like, the silver innervation.
They're already here. They're already part. Like,
they're already part of Thunderhead's infrastructure. Like, when did that happen?
It's always been like that, apparently.
What? Why? How? When?
Because they... Okay, so to back up, because Thunderhead is built around Shadowbolt Tower, which is the, like, major structure of the core, it's never been, like... it is only connected to its power grid when they activate the defense systems, which is what will happen. It's so, like, Lighthooves is... Like, this is a weird thing. Like, Lighthooves' dumb plan won't even work because he's... He wants to kill all of, like, Navarro and stuff like that, but the second he turns on the defense systems, the microwave hallway will happen to the entirety of Thunderhead all at once, apparently, meaning none of this goddamn has ever mattered.
So what has changed in 200 years that makes this system that bad?
The Eater of Souls, the Tokomera, the fucking stupid alien spaceship is woken up, which we knew from previous chapters.
So all this is only stupid while the alien, while the space demon is conscious.
Yes.
While it's asleep, otherwise this power plant should work perfectly fine.
Yes. It's a lot of convoluted nonsense to get us to. When he turns on that machine, it's going to be a giant death fog.
It's, that is pretty funny to me that this place was doomed.
Yes.
and actually this entire field trip was in large parts pointless. I'm not sure what they're trying to accomplish up here anymore.
I don't think Somber has any idea either. This is just the Reaper Ranger War again, where they actually accomplished nothing. And their presence was completely pointless. In fact, it might have been actively detrimental for them to be there at all. This weirdly keeps happening.
It's what happens when you don't have an outline. It's what happens when you, like, don't understand, like, how to structure... When your understanding of how to structure even a scene is so bad that the only way you know how to close out, like, a moment in time is to knock the protagonist unconscious.
Or get struck by lightning.
By hook, by croaker, lightning strike. By hook, by croaker, bolt from heaven.
Yep. But like, it's, I really need to establish, like, how dumb this, like, this, how dumb and, like, bad the writing is in this scene, especially. Because this is, like, this is the worst kind of exposition. It's not even exposition where, like, you have, like, oh, I'm an old wizened man who knows everything. It's just the main character is just figuring stuff out because they, like, need to know things by now, and that, like, the author didn't adequately explain any of their details very well in the previous chapter. So it's a lot of, like, letters to the audience kind of stuff. So they realize that the plan is that they're going to get enervated to death. Also, sorry, go ahead.
Real quick, because I'm bored and frustrated, I just, like, want to say another, like, painfully missed opportunity is you could have, like, you could have a complicated and interesting intrigue where you have Silverhooves, this, like, power-hungry lunatic, this power-hungry monster who desperately, desperately wants to be the most important person on the Cinder. And then in the wings, you have this Necron Queen. You have Dawn, who is a maddened agent of an eldritch terror, and this power hungry fascist Lighthooves thinks that he's going to, like, destroy the entire world save for this tiny bubble, this snow globe that will be his in a ruined world. Meanwhile, his main backer, Dawn, is just ginning up as much conflict as possible, and Lighthooves happens to be the most useful asset toward that, because mm-hmm. she has affixed the silver innervation metal to generators throughout. Yes. Like,
it's actually more insane to think about, like, the way that this is really going down, is that Dawn's plan and Lighthooves' plan are utterly divorced from each other. They just happen to coincide with the same location.
Yeah. Anyway, I'd rather be listening to a story about how the folly of ambition plays into the hands of a greater darkness. but
that would require like planning out your escalation correctly.
And caring about things and having ideals, having like themes that you're trying to express.
Well, all right, we need to get over this really brain dead.
Yeah, let's move on to the next thing.
Hey, we gotta get over the next.
Enough of me masturbating over
the next brain dead thing. So yeah, so like I really need to like I really really need to establish how much this scene is really just the characters all standing around inside of a like inside of a warship that's about to go battle other warships, and like the main characters just the main characters just standing around realizing things for themselves basically because like there is no other plan for the exposition. It's just a bunch of them standing around going like, huh, I just realized all those things from the previous chapter. Like, it dawns on them that, like, wait a second. Light Hooves beat me so handily. It's not because he was wearing power armor. I got it. I know why that armor looks so familiar. It looked like my old cybernetics. Light Hooves is a cyborg now. He must have somehow gotten control of Project Steel Hooves, and he's manufactured new cybernetics that he's going to be used to fill into Thunderhead. To make a new elite force of cyborgs, which is a leap in logic.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
it's a bit
clearly
of a
clearly we can deduce.
It's a bit of a leap of logic if it wasn't absolutely goddamn true.
Of course it is, because all theories are like
it.
It's amazing. I love it. I love how stupid it is. And I'm trying to remember the specific, like, Sherlock Holmes parody that I'm thinking of. This is a well-worn trope, and I'm always happy to see it. The hyper-intelligent character notices there's a blue stain on white shoes. Ah, yes, it's all coming together. Based on this piece of evidence alone. The plot to assassinate the queen.
Yes, obviously. But for part two of this insane thing, like this is some pretty intense dramatic timing. And at the moment she realizes that like shit, he's arming an army of cyborg soldiers. A bunch of an army of cyborg soldiers bursts into the building and she starts fighting them.
also, like, I want to give just a moment of mention to like that means that Light Hooves is such a golden child. He overcame the need for the Maltese.exe. Like he did this thing that required the Maltese.exe in spite of never getting his hands on it. So the Maltese XA becoming increasingly important with each passing chapter.
Well, it's supposed to be this stupid thing from earlier on that like when they released the seal on Steel Pony, anyone who knew how could access it, I guess. So I guess he could just be like, oh cool, my like that like the password protected file on this old computer just has it open now. But like I just like I want to bring up the fact that like how fucking insane this whole sequence is, because there's also like a lot of like it's like because like when they see the new cyborgs are like, oh, they're all manufactured from brand new parts and they're all like, oh, they're so much more dangerous than even I am. And it's like how somber. Did you forget the part that like the Enclave is a failing wreck that is using literally 200-year-old battleships because they don't have any way of refreshing their technology.
Mm-mm. Perfectly preserved mothball. Everything is pre-lapsarian up here.
Yes.
All of those cyborgs are so perfect and efficient and better than Blackjack, because even though Blackjack was assembled by the top minds of the waste, was assembled by like all the gathered resources of the best and brightest of the reconstructionists. Nope, up here everything is in pristine working order. a perfect preservation of the old order, and so they're so much better at it. K-Cat is dead. Only Sombra reigns now.
Long leg of the queen, etc., etc. Long live the whiskey queen. But yeah, BJ kills a couple of them and like talks about how cool their cybernecks are and like how they're all brand new, which is fucking insane. There's a really ridiculous exchange that's like funny to me if you think about it in context, where like Stormfront is like battling a bunch of them, of course, because she's an old Nazi, she's a cool badass, in cool power armor, she's beating a bunch of them, and there's like this like exchange between two of them where like one of the random cyborgs are like, "We are the future of the Enclave," and then she gets clowned by Stormfront, and she's like, "I'm not impressed." And like, the reason why it's funny to me is like, imagine being in that room and having literally nothing to the Enclave, and like, no, you know nothing about what's going on, about like the socio-political scenario, and like, you just have this random unnamed cybernetic dude run up and fight a Nazi, and like. It gets like, and is like, "We are the future," and like, because we have there's no indication there's ever been like a like generational disparity, like you know, like there's never been any like indication of like Enclave boomers oppressing the Enclave millennial or the Enclave zoomer. So this is just completely lost on us entirely. It's just, it has nothing like. It makes no sense without like in that context. It just seemed really funny to me. Like it really sort of accidentally lampooned how unrelated this entire storyline is to the general plotline. Like, man, there's a lot of shit going up in the sky that we have nothing to do with, and why are we here? They fight cyborgs. Like, I cannot stand along. This is a 22,000 long word thing, and most of them, I would say 20,000 of them, is about cyborgs fighting. It is exhausting. So I get to, you fine folks get to hear me just talk about it instead of having to go through it.
Yeah. And you're a hero. You're doing us a great, great service in this. Meanwhile, I'm sure somebody on Sombra's team is thinking about like. No, because like I know authors who use themes, greater themes in their work. They're all cowards. like I was just thinking about the whole like premise of K-Cath's story, that like the land friendship forgot was an important element to it. Mm-hmm. And you have this eldritch god, and like I don't know, just thinking about the interesting implications of it feeds on souls, and so it wants more death, more dead. And so, like, a force that personifies the inability of people to talk to each other and get along, feasting on the chaos. And yet, Lighthose isn't a part of any of that.
Yeah, he's just a guy.
When you think he should be a pawn of it, like, when you think he should be, like, ultimately, like...
Yeah, he just independently is a Nazi. Entirely unrelated to the Dark God swimming around deep beneath the earth, plotting the destruction and downfall of all of ponykind. And he's just like, "I'm just a Nazi."
Yeah, anyway. So yeah, fighting battleborgs. Battling.
Yeah, big bad battleborgs. Stormfront gets hurt, and we're supposed to care, I guess, because she's like, there's a lot of propping up of the idea that like, General Nazi Pwn here is like one of the good ones, and so like you're supposed to care that like, oh no, one of the good ones, like there's literally a line like, fuck, I almost forgot about this, where Black Deck is thinking in her brain, "No, I need her, the Enclave needs her." just god, fuck off. Like, just, like, I don't have anything important to say about that, but, like, fuck off. Like, the concept of just be like, no, we need this Nazi general over your other Nazi generals. Just fuck off. Just stop, Somber. Like, grow up.
But fine, harm reduction.
Oh, yeah, I forgot Canon, I forgot that in Canon, Rampage is the worst character, and that we've kind of, like, made her into a better character than she is in the story. Because, like, BJ is, like, getting pissy with Rampage, and Rampage starts a temper tantrum. And this is meant to come across as more chilling and scary, but like it really just comes across as like a child throwing
petulant.
Well, because she's just like, don't you ever talk to me like that ever again. You care about things. I don't care about things, and you won't even kill me, so I don't even care about anything anymore. Because it's setting up the fact that she's going to be the traitor, so, like, I don't care about this version of Rampage at all. She's dead to me. But it's just, it's really nice to know that Rampage has learned literally nothing. Like, literally nothing. Like, any illusion of character growth is just a vague whisper, but like it's also just really annoying to have characters like this talk down to our protagonist, because it's like one of those things where like you don't, because it undercuts like a lot of the things you've established with Rampage and Blackjack's relationship, that like apparently like Rampage can just go off the deep end at any time and she's just a ticking time bomb still, and that like Blackjack has had such a little effect on her that like she's still willing to just like, I'll just kill you if I don't like you anymore. Which, like, in our own particular reading of Rampage is, like, a fun a la carte. That's kind of a fun idea of, like, you know, I'm humoring you, but, like, don't get on my bad side or I'll kill you. But, like, this is more like, don't ever talk down to me because you're dirt, because I don't like you anymore. And not because you're, like, a bootlicker and, like, capitulates to slavery and stuff, but because you're, like, not mean enough and you're not hard enough and you care about things. Like, that's what it really comes down to. Like,
it's a baby's conception of a matures only adult.
Yes, it's like, because her argument is basically like, people die, it happens every day, like why should you care about these ones, and like why should you care about good or bad or anything like that. And it's just like, it's just insanely childish.
Yeah, I think that the main thing to focus on there is it's a wacky inversion of our conception of the character, our conception of how this dynamic should be working. You're a piece of shit because like you constantly won't shut up about your high and mighty morals, and yet you capitulate at every turn where it matters.
Yeah, but this version of Rampage is like, you're too soft, and I hate that. And I mean, like, realistically, because she's, like, because she's threatening to kill Blackjack at this point, like, I wanted nothing more than just Blackjack to be like, okay, and just push her off the ship. Like, hey, you're a liability, cool. Like,
yeah,
you're a danger to me and everyone else around me, bye. Like, not even mad, just like, it's like, okay, I can't deal with you being a time bomb while I'm dealing with all this other shit. Go regenerate from falling a terminal velocity for a while. I don't care anymore. But that doesn't happen because, like, Blackjack kowtows to literally everyone who ever yells at her because she's a useless garbage protagonist.
Because she's a cop!
Yep. Luckily, Rampage's doctor personality comes out to play because they need to save somebody from medical dangers, and I don't care who it was and why they getting brought back, whatever. It's so that Rampage's dumb personality gets to, like, dumb doctor self, Dr. Octopus, gets to play, like, psychoanalysis, because we need to get more exposition about what's going on. And, like, so a thing that's not very well structured by the story is that, like, Light Hooves doesn't want to rule. He wants Thunderhead to be permanently safe, and his way of doing that is, like, treating himself as a sacrificial lamb or some shit like that, so that he can die for Thunderhead's sins and be protect it that way. Because we're establishing that, oh, also, Light Hooves is another... Sorry.
I'm the hero of this floating island, but needs to deserve to want to need to deserve to want.
But we're establishing that Light Hooves is just another dark mirror of Blackjack. There is this... we'll be getting into it in next chapter, or I guess part two, but there's a fucking genuinely insane... like, pathology that is being established here with this, that is, like, actually makes me worried about Somber's, like, actual mental state, because they split the hair that, and this is reinforced more later on, he's not suicidal, he's just self-destructive. And I've talked about this before, about, like, how this frames it as such, that there is such a thing as a good kind of sacrifice, and that is a dangerous pathology to have. About anything, but the idea that it matters, like, there's a noticeable distinction between, like, I want to destroy myself and I want to kill myself, as if like that matters at all. Like, it's just one is just slower than the other, is really just the argument, as far as I can tell. It's like, you're self-destructive, which means you don't worry if you get hurt, but you're suicidal if you want to kill yourself personally. But, like, that doesn't matter. Like, that has no meaningful distinction to a person's personality or behavior. It's just how fast you kill yourself, I guess. But this is established as being, like, a big critical emotional theme thing that really defines the character, I guess, but I just don't give a shit. We get a brief glimpse, because they're like flying over Thunderhead. They can actually like see the core for once overhead, and they see like the whole thing of it. And there's like this ridiculous thing about it that like BJ like looks into it. And it's like, oh, it's this twisted husk. No, this was not a pony city. Some dark thing created this city. And it's like, okay, slow your roll. It's just a bunch of fallen over buildings. But the thing that they notice about it that's very distinct is that there's like a weird, mysterious green glow that emanates from the center of the core now, which I'm assuming is just supposed to be the Eater of Souls is waking up. There's a lot of dogfighting. Like, something I've kind of like skipped from this chapter is the notion that there's like a lot of dogfighting, a lot of characters no one gives a shit about. Like a bunch of like captains getting blown up, and a bunch of like snooty evil villain dudes doing stuff. We find out that Navarro's plan is they're going to steal the warheads and they're going to use them themselves, which just like really muddies a lot of like who's supposed to be the good guy here. Like, is it just supposed to be like everyone's a bastard? But like, contextually, you haven't set that up, Sounder. Like, it's really odd to me that like Thunderhead is characterized as being like ignorant of the evil it does, because it doesn't realize that like it's you know, it's prelapsarian golden age. It's being protected by like a CIA dark state that is that makes sure that everything works efficiently. And Navarro, on the other hand, is supposed to be like sort of a totalitarian fascist state. But like, all of the Navarro generals and commanders that we've met through Blackjack are like really nice and cordial, and they're not like, not in that like well-written way where it's like, oh yeah, I'm a proper British naval officer, but I also just kill slaves. Like not that. It's just, no, they're just, it's unironically, they're all nice people that are just happen to be working for the wrong kind of organization. So like, I don't understand, like there's this attempt of the myopia of like, oh yeah, everybody's bastards, but which is very common in these kind of stories, but contextually, Navarro and Thunderhead are still framed as being, like, kind of still good guys. Like, it's like, oh, shucks, they didn't know that all their leaders were evil. You can't blame them. There's a speech at some point in this where Stormfront is like, ordered to stand down, and they have to give up, basically. And Rampage yells at them again, I guess, because why not? But there's that really stupid kind of scene where, like, you know, we get to see the like the how motherly and great Stormfront was as a character, and that like all of her like underlings, all of her soldiers are all like, you know, permission to speak freely, sir. Fuck that noise. We're gonna do it anyways and be big damn heroes, and like that's what they're doing. And it's like, oh, I guess, sure. It's just like, a lot of this stuff just like contextually is really bad to me, because it's all like, this is still Nazis. Like, I have no interest in rooting for them, but sure, whatever. So their plan to get in there, because apparently they're now worried that they're going to get, so we're almost done the chapter. Actually, we're almost done part one. So, this one went by really fast, just because it was like, what the fuck was I there to talk about besides dogfighting? But BJ's really silly plan to get into, because they need to get into the tower proper now, because that's the actual like dungeon instance of this particular storyline, is they get on a cloud, and then BJ just like telekinetically scoots it into the direction of the Shadow Bolt Tower, and so that's where we leave our chapter, is her and Rampage. What?
Just the sound of, like, just you're trying to visualize, like, Everybody bundle up on a cloud and just like scoosh, scoosh.
I just imagine it making like the putt putt noises.
Yeah, but, I mean that's too fast and consistent. Like because we've established she struggles with like magic often or does I don't or no no she's I guess she's a telekinetic master by this point. Like
either way, it's funny. Even...
For me, the joke was that like she like squeezes her eyes like in like the cloud herks forward.
Yeah,
with a squit sound. She just has to do that over and over.
So they poop grunt their way to Shadowbolt Tower, and that's the end of part one. Here, let's revive a segment. Any thoughts about part one so far of our finale?
No.
Yeah, like I don't even...
it's all been said. Like that, we have no reason to care about either of these factions. We're supposed to care about a character that was at least not introduced this chapter. Like it was set up two chapters ago, which is way more forward planning than we usually get for these characters we're suddenly supposed to like care about. I guess Lighthoof's motives get even more confusing and twisted. That like he's like trying to just set himself up as a bad guy whose legacy like will provide a good example through like a good negative example to the future. I guess is his goal. It's very and yet he's like, who the fuck is? I suppose we're supposed to assume that he's set up his ideal candidates to fill in the vacuums he's created in leadership.
I guess.
None of these questions are considered. it's all very boring.
Yes, that I think that's the thing that really sticks with me about Thunderhead 2020 has been like, fuck, is this boring? Like, it's boring and bad, and it's like, and it is absolutely. A COVID-19 warning just went off. Don't mind me. So I just lost my train of thought. But it's so destructive to the setting at large. That's the thing about this is that like the worst part about all of this is that if you count any amount, like because it for better or for worse, the story is really influential, and I think that's for worse, obviously, because. It means that if you include any of this, you have to include all of this. And if you include all of this, you have to reckon around the fact that, like, no matter what story you're telling, there was a time in which 50,000 people were just up in the sky, just chilling, just doing nothing related to the story, which makes, like, anyone else's story feel infinitesimal in comparison, utterly, utterly insignificant. And I think one of the things they really, like, I think that's what the thing that the most aggravating thing about Project Horizons and like its effect on the audience is how it makes all other works feel smaller in its comparison, and not because of quality, but because of its like deliberate actions to like talk down to the original author and to establish so much extra lore that like has to be included if you count this as canon, and meaning that like no matter what you make, it's always going to be in the shadow of this.
You know something I'm suddenly reminded of, and I don't know if I brought this up in the podcast, but
no, probably not.
During the New 52 reboot, when the DC tried to like, all right, clean slate, let's start telling these characters over again without all the like weight of decades of lore, contradictory lore from multiple conflicting authors. Let's clean the slate, start over again like we did with Crisis on Infinite Earths, which was, at the time, Crisis, good marketing decision, sound plan, it worked. But now the lunatics run the asylum, and by which I mean the fucking fanboys.
Yes.
And so New 52... utterly failed because they couldn't divorce themselves from the old lore and the new direction they had for all these characters. The character designs were shitty. It was very sort of Snyderverse inspired. So it was all bad. The characters were out of character. None of the core appeal of any of these characters was preserved, and it had all the problems. Like it was not new customer base facing. Normally the reason you do a Crisis on Infinite Earths is to like set the stage for an entire new generation of fans to come in. Like, you don't need to know anything in order to read this book. It is the new 52. Welcome to the new age of our property. Also, here's a backlog of 40 years of comics.
Yeah, get reading.
But anyway, I think it was Grant Morrison. I'm going to feel real dumb if it wasn't Grant Morrison.
It was probably still Grant Morrison.
Who was put in charge of writing Superman New 52, the reboot for Superman, the post-crisis reboot for Superman. And that fucking asshole typified everything that was wrong with the project because he only had like a book or two on the line. He was only like contracted, guaranteed, so on to be able to write two graphic novels worth, like sort of like 24 chapters or so of New 52 Superman. And it opened real strong. It opened with a pretty good premise for like you'd think if you had an editor working at DC, which I don't think they do anymore. You'd think that that person's job would be to say, okay, your job right now is to set up what Superman is going to be like for the next decade. And other writers are going to come in and they're going to develop this character from the starting point you create. And the first like two or three issues is like that. Like Grant sets up a pretty good standard for like, okay, here's a new baseline for Superman to like grow from. Like,
all right, we can't run too much longer. So
anyway, long story short, the back end of his run, his run on Superman New 52 is a garbled, confusing, crazy fucking mess because he just had to crowbar in his version of every staple Superman character. Like it is a clusterfuck of faces and names that tumble into the book, the diseases in the Monty Burns is immune to everything meme.
Yeah,
exploding through the door, because he just had to put his scent on every Superman idea before he got out the door. Nothing could be left to any other author to define.
Yes,
it all had to be him.
Yeah. Coming back and around, this is this is our Grant Morrison, everyone.
And that explains all of these long, stupid lore diatribes throughout this story that impact the actual story being told 0%. They just have to be in there so that they're in the wiki,
yes.
So that they count. That is literally somber peeing on K Cat's work.
So I think the dark comedy of that though, I think the how K Cat got him in the end though, I think that's funny about that is that the wiki is almost utterly devoid of any of the Project Horizons content. the plot summary is blank. The only way you can get the lore of Project Horizons, you have to read the individual character entries, which makes side characters like Morningstar fucking impossible to learn because they're a single line of data within Dawn's backstory, and that's it. But yeah, like that's I think the thing to really sell how impotent all this shit is. Like, there were a lot of fucking like Reddit loser Project Horizon stands that can like go fucking die off a cliff for all I give a shit about, but like how insignificant all of this fucking world building really is it amounts to a blank page on a Wikipedia no one looks at anymore. Like, that is your look upon my works, ye mighty in despair. Like, the tragic twist of that, the irony of that is that it's a fucking, it's a eroded foot in the desert, you fucking idiot. Oh, God. Anyways, I think it's enough trashing. Somber for this week. We'll get into a lot more of it next week. I don't really even remember how next chapter... I know how the next chapter ends, because we're going to be going right into book five after that, after we do our recap and all that stuff. But, like, book five is, you know, what we're looking forward to, what I've been looking forward to, where it goes, like, super off the rails. Like, not in a good way, but it's fun to watch, at least. Setting up the whole, like, Rampage is the traitor stuff. We're gonna finally see the inside of the core. We're finally gonna be able to deal with all of the long straining threads on everything. Setting up for the fucking Naruto style ninja war. Gonna be doing all the crazy stuff. There'll be excerpts from Johnny Cash's rendition of Hurt playing at one point.
I'm just a direct response to the thing you just said. That's
just no.
That's all the commentary I've got is just a pained sigh.
Just no. We'll be meeting Shodan. We'll be meeting Sauron. There'll be more tanks, more robots, more zebras, more action, less sense. A pony named Toaster, who's my favorite character in the whole story, because he wears armor made of toasters. And yeah, that'll be book five. But till then, you can contact us at our relevant Twitters. I'm thou at Phi. I'm extremely not safe for work. I'm extremely not safe for work. I'm very political and also toxic to male fans, as I've been told. You can find Weird at Weirdington.
I cast my masculinity aside, Jojo.
It's good.
I'm at Weirdington E on Twitter. I am also pretty political, but I'm trying to just like retweet like cute good art and animals and like stop being so like almost like rabidly angry at politics. You can email us directly at my email, which is weirdingtonesq@gmail.com. I want to give a special shout out to an anonymous benefactor who donated an obscene, well, what to me is an obscene amount of money, I'm going to do my best to sit on. I've spent about $100 on groceries. I wish I hadn't given exact amounts. Anyway, I've spent the bulk of it on groceries. Old Weirdington ain't gonna starve anytime soon. I was hoping to spend some of it on a new mic, but I forgot that the logistics of that required things operating like they did in the before times. So I'm not sure where I'm going to buy a microphone from.
Just hook up old can on a shoestring.
But the goal of the money, like, anyway. But yes, and then I'll pad it with dollars. more expensive the microphone, the better the quality. So I papier-mâchéed some $100 bills to this can.
That's pretty good.
Can you think of anything better we could be?
Recommendations. I mean, the only thing I've been really doing in these ever trying times has mostly been like playing video games as I usually do. I recommend Hades. Hades is really, really, really good. It's made by the folks that brought us stuff like Transistor. So it's got that like fucking great writing, but it's also just a really fun game, and I enjoy it a lot. And its art's just gorgeous. Just maybe one of my favorite games of all time now. But that's the only thing I can think of that I can recommend off the top of my dome piece.
I'm excited to recommend two things. Maggie Mae Fish's Cats video. I've been an aficionado of Cats videos recently. There's been a lot of pretty good ones, like really like trying to express the existential horror of watching it, especially before it became a full-on Rocky Horror Picture Show experience. And I hope in the aftermath of the current shape of the world, that can come back for people, that they'll like be draft house screenings of Cats where people can just have fun yelling at the screen. So there's that. So Hades, Maggie Mae Fish's Cats, T.S. Eliot video. My ADHD made me forget mid-mention that the thing that's interesting about Maggie Mae Fish's Cats review is that she doesn't talk about cats. She talks about T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. I never knew that he was such a piece of shit.
But yeah, I think that's the end of our podcast, though, so I think you should play us out.
Don't forget to tweet us, email us, and because otherwise, this has definitely all been some sort of terrible mistake.
But I couldn't come home in the dark.